Early in 2022, I decided to start looking into Aldous Huxley and his book, Brave New World. I must confess, I've never read his books. That isn't what interested me. I wanted to understand why someone could write books about things that happened nearly 100 years after they'd written the initial book. I realised after a short space of time that I'd opened a door into a secret world. Not just the world of Aldous Huxley, but the world of his whole family. In this presentation, we will be looking at the highly influential, multi-generational Huxley family. This series will be called The Huxley's Brave New World Order. This is the first in the series, and this one's called Echoes of the Huxleys. Before I begin, I'd like to thank Lorraine for her help in the information gathering stages of the Huxley investigations, and the constant read-throughs she helped me with. Please remember that this is only the introduction. This is not a complete deep dive into the Huxley family. That will come in future presentations. As always, though, we will only use information taken from the mainstream public domain. Just who are these flockers?
Today, we are faced, I think, with the approach of what may be called the ultimate revolution, the final revolution, where a man can act directly on the mind-body of his fellows. Well, needless to say, some kind of direct action on human mind-bodies has been going on since the beginning of time. But this has generally been of a violent nature. The techniques of terrorism have been known from time immemorial, and people have employed them with more or less ingenuity, sometimes with the utmost crudity, sometimes with a good deal of skill acquired by a process of trial and error, finding out what the best ways of using torture, imprisonment, constraints of various kinds. But I think it was Metternich said many years ago, you can do everything with bayonets except sit on them. That if you are going to control any population for any length of time, you must have some measure of consent. It's exceedingly difficult to see how pure terrorism can function indefinitely. It can function for a fairly long time, but I think sooner or later you have to bring in an element of persuasion, an element of getting people to consent to what is happening to them. Well, it seems to me that the nature of the ultimate revolution with which we are now faced is precisely this, that we are in process of developing a whole series of techniques which will enable the controlling oligarchy, who have always existed and presumably always will exist, to get people actually to love their servitude. Love their servitude. Love their servitude.
Welcome to this new Sheep Farm Meet the Flockers podumentary presentation. This is the first in a series called The Huxleys, Brave New World Order. And this is part one, Echoes of the Huxleys. Part one is an introduction of sorts, and not specifically just about the Huxleys, rather the synchronicities and links back to the various Huxleys. And you'll see this as we go through it. Giving examples of academic nepotism that is used to control us, the goyim. The Huxleys are a British family and a who's who of British academic society. Many of its family members have excelled in science, medicine, the arts, journalism and literature. The family includes members who have occupied senior positions in politics, the BBC, and NGOs like World Wildlife Fund or UNESCO, and the intelligence services. To the public, the Huxleys are probably an underestimated lineage that hide behind the famous shadow of author Aldous Huxley. However, the patriarch of the family was biologist, anthropologist, zoologist, anatomist, known as Darwin's bulldog, Thomas Henry Huxley. Thomas Huxley was born in 1825 and died in 1895, and was right there at the epicentre of the academic and financial reset, which occurred sometime in the mid-1800s, when they, or they live, were discussing evolution and eugenics theories that have continued to haunt and shape our lives ever since. His grandsons were Aldous Huxley, the author of Brave New World and The Doors of Perception, and Aldous's elder brother was Sir Julian Huxley, who was another evolutionary biologist. He was the president of the British Eugenics Society and first director of UNESCO and co-founder of the World Wildlife Fund and the man who invented transhumanism. In fact, he coined the term. His other grandson was Sir Andrew Huxley, and he was a Nobel laureate physiologist. In this introduction, we will show examples of other academic dynasties and other information that is intertwined with the Huxley story. In the coming series, we'll dissect the Huxley family tree, covering generations of Huxleys who have changed the way we live. And lastly, we will cover Thomas Huxley, Julian Huxley, Aldous Huxley, and Andrew Huxley in detail. There is no doubt that the Brave New World prophecies are in evidence today, playing out on the human population. Brave New World certainly epitomises the situation we're facing now. As I say in Yorkshire, it was bang on the money. This research was like walking into a spider's web. It was right there in front of my eyes, or our eyes, but we only ever see it at the last millisecond before we walk into it. That's how close we are to the truth, and that's how close we need to get to the truth. What this Huxley research has done, for me, and I hope for you guys as well, is reaffirm the mosaic's pattern, making the picture clearer. So we can then visually see the strands in the fabric within the tapestry of the matrix. We're then looking right through the veil covering their lie of our reality. The problem is, we cannot yet decipher the code. It's there though, just like the spider's web, but it's a web of deceit. What we're seeing are the matrix's zeros and ones. And that's what the Huxley dynasty is. They are the zeros and ones. They are the living matrix. Joining me tonight, as usual, is our Chris. How are you doing?
Good evening. You all right?
Evening, yes. Well. What would you say to that intro, Chris? I know it was quite long.
That's a good intro. It's nice so far.
Yeah. Mm. It sort of gets the sort of juices flowing to what I sort of uncovered and linked together, and when we've been talking about it, we've also found new bits of information that are intertwined in the Huxley story.
Mm. I like the use of the word podumentary.
Podumentary, yeah.
You tried docu-podcast, but that wasn't quite as catchy.
No, docu-podcast.
You love making words up, don't you?
I don't think I made that up, to be fair, Chris.
I think it's out there.
No,
I think
it's out there, mate. I thought I had, but I've probably heard it somewhere else. So, first question to you. Before I started going on about this, what did you know about the Huxleys prior to me starting this research back in January 2021?
I reckon they first came on my radar, probably not even at school because I was too thick to read a book like Brave New World, I would say. It was probably around when the film came out, the Doors film. Do you remember that? Because I remember a lot of people were carrying that book around with them because they'd watched the Doors film, then they'd gone back and listened to Doors. Yeah. In fact, I found out, because I remember they re-released the book, The Doors of Perception, with Jim Morrison on the front, but it was Val Kilmer because it was to promote the film, if you remember.
Yeah.
And then people started saying, oh, have you read this book? It's this guy who took acid and blah, blah. And I never read it myself, Doors of Perception.
Right.
And then I went on to read Brave New World when I got a bit older. Read that a few times.
So that was around, and you're talking of around when you were at college, around the second
90s.
Summer of Love. era.
Just after, yeah. Just like after. So the Summer of Love had happened. All the acid stuff had come out, you know.
Yeah.
And then it kind of continued into the 90s, I'd say, wouldn't you? The Summer of Love kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, with Ecstasy, I suppose, then, after acid were a big thing.
Yeah.
But it kind of continued. And I think people, I don't remember when that film came out. I'm guessing that film came out in the 90s, early 90s.
Yeah.
But then I remember I was in London in, yeah, like 1991. And I remember someone had that book then.
Right.
So that's when Aldous Huxley first came on my radar. First time I'd heard of him.
Yeah.
I think it was about 1991.
So it's sort of reinserted back into popular culture due to the second Summer of Love, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, he was behind promoting the first Summer of Love. And then they went on to bring the Summer of Love back again, didn't they?
Yeah.
Even used the same name and, as we're going to talk about, the same imagery, which was the smiley face.
Smiley face. And also, I mean, acid music. I mean, it was actually called acid music, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So, you know, they weren't hiding it this time. It weren't, I mean, I'm not saying they did it in the 60s, but they certainly weren't hiding it. And it were mainly this country as well. So this country got hit. And a lot of the major DJ stars.
I think it even started up north, didn't it? I think it was.
No, I think the
northern clubs were more famous.
They were popping up all over, I think, the illegal parties, but
service stations, all that.
Yeah, I think Danny Ramplin, who's obviously talking out about the whole nonsense now, he was part of one of the main DJs at that
point. Well, I started going clubbing in the early 90s, so just after that, so I was only like 17, 16.
Yeah.
But when you think about that, well, even the acid ones, when you think about that, so you've got all these guys going to a field or whatever, taking drugs that they don't know where they've got, where they've even come from, which was similar again to the 60s, apparently.
Yeah.
On a strip, and then they play music, trance music.
Yes.
Probably even harder core than they were in the 60s, because it's actually mind bending trance music. Yeah. I mean, if you want to guinea pig a load of people,
give them a load of acid.
And give them
music called trance.
Trance, bleeps, and I mean, you remember the footage from the 80s, you're like, what the hell is going on there?
Yeah.
And then it kind of continued with Ecstasy, didn't it? Where if you think of a club where they had, when those clubs became super clubs, it were clearly the drugs were controlled, weren't they? They were controlled by certain people. So they'd give the drugs out with certain symbols on them as well. God knows what they meant at the time.
Yeah.
And then certain, what a way. I mean, if you're watching a reaction of what happens to people, it's like a bloody
fishbowl.
A test lab, isn't it?
Yeah. But most of those Ecstasy tablets, and we're going to talk about that further on, but most of those Ecstasy tablets were coming in from Holland, I do believe, Amsterdam.
Yeah,
And so they were coming from one area. So, all right, they were drug dealers, but they had to get the raw materials from somewhere. Mm. And so these people were allowed to function and then import all these things. And like the first Summer of Love, when it were all peace and love, after a year, it became a drugs war, and people were getting whacked and all sorts of stuff in this country. And also, there was lots of violence, weren't there?
The manufacturing of those products, the acid tabs, that's a scientific endeavour. It's not just someone doing it in the bedroom, is it?
No, it isn't. No, and you only need to change, I would have thought, part of that ingredient list to make that acid tab to send people gaga. Bear in mind, in the late 80s, 90s, that technology were then 60, 70 years old. So they probably got them chemicals down to a fine art, hadn't they? That they knew 25 years later what them people who did all that were going to become.
Mm. Yeah.
That experiment had already been done. You know, they've been testing it on military people for years. So, but I mean, out of that came stuff like Blur and Oasis and, well, the Manchester Sound were before that. So all these things that were I mean, Mark Devlin will know this better than us, but all these orchestrated events that looked organic, now looking back, don't seem as organic, do they?
No. I mean, I think I started going clubbing before you did.
You did.
But you felt like you were part of a movement, didn't you? A rebel.
Yes. Even. Yeah.
And that's the same thing they did in the 60s.
You were guinea pigs, really.
Well, you're actually probably guinea pigs, yeah.
Yeah. Do you know what I think with the drug, they used to call it the drug scene.
Mm.
ironically. But I think with the drug scene, if you think what that would do, right, let's just say somebody took a drug, whatever it would be, and then they're dancing for 2 hours. Instantly, you're automatically turned on that pharmaceuticals work.
Mm. Well, yeah.
Even though they're illegal, yeah?
You're popping a pill, aren't you?
Yeah. So you're automatically... I look at it a bit like some mates who took steroids when they were training. Same thing. Mm. They're injecting things, so injections work. It's that mind. Anybody looking at a bodybuilder who trains putting 3 stone of muscle on competing in Mr. Olympia, it's an advertisement that drugs work.
Yeah. Another, just on a slightly parallel subject, I've always thought, for instance, in the 80s, if you think, Scarface, for instance.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone wanted to be Tony Montana, even though he's an evil, horrible bastard. But look how they glamorized cocaine fire.
Mm.
And that was basically an advert for cocaine.
Yes. Yeah.
And there were a few other films like that. But that more than any, I think, was literally an advertisement. Written by Oliver Stone, by the way.
Well, and again,
written by Oliver Stone, who also directed The Doors.
Yeah. Well, does it surprise us that these things come back round? And also, out of that came the grunge movement, which, that again, it came after the 60s Summer of Love, where it sort of went really dark and horrible. This is not about the first Summer of Love, by the way. What we're looking at here is where the researchers taken me anyway, and then me and Chris had had a conversation, and he said, well, it links to that as well. And the Huxleys were brought back in, or Aldous Huxley's books were brought back into society.
Yeah, that's
and
what I was
the
to
doors
say.
Were brought back in to that generation again for some reason, and acid and all these other things. So it regurgitated back round again for a second hit.
Yeah.
And so Nirvana then took the dirtier side, and obviously
that's where all that heroin music came from, didn't it?
Yeah,
emotional, like, you know, greasy flick,
depressing,
hanging down. Have you noticed the logo for Nirvana?
Go on.
It's the smiley face as we're talking, and it's got. I only noticed this the other day. It's got crossed eyes and its tongue hanging out like it's dead.
Yeah. Well, does that really surprise you?
What happened to old Kurt Cobain? I mean, all they had to do was put a blooming chunk missing outside of his head.
Yeah, and it had a blood splot in it, didn't it?
Has it got a blood splot on it?
I think one of them's got. I think. Oh no, that's the Watchmen that you talked about earlier.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about that because the smiley face is quite an interesting one, and you also had that Forrest Gump going through the 60s.
Yeah. Well, they made out in the Forrest Gump film that he invented the smiley face, didn't they?
Yeah, when he wipes his face on that.
He's doing that run, he wipes his face, and he's got it on it. Quite funny. Yeah. But, again, brought back again and again, the old smiley face. And one of the main links we had or thought of, I think Mark mentioned this in his book, is the smiley face in old Watchmen.
Yeah.
And that came out, if I remember, because I was a big comic fan, still am actually, but like 1987, it was, 86, 87, it was written as a series. I think I bought it in 1988, 89, I reckon.
Right.
And that re-brought the smiley face back again for the, I mean, I'm sure it was responsible partly because it was everywhere. And then it came back for the second Summer of Love.
So isn't it strange that you've got acid, which adopts the smiley face, you've got grunge, Nirvana, that adopts a smiley face. And a few years before acid, more or less the same time, you've got Alan Moore writing a comic that adopts a smiley face, that becomes the face of acid.
Mm.
All organic, Chris.
Yeah, it must be.
All
and
organic.
Then you've got Alan Moore, who's a known Crowleyite occultist magician.
Yeah.
But yeah, to be fair, his comic books are amazing, to be honest with you. I was crazy about all his stuff. I've got a lot of his comics. He wrote one, I don't know if I forgot to mention this to you, he wrote one of the last ones of books, I don't buy so many anymore, and it's called Necromicon, and it's literally about H.P. Lovecraft and the coming of a demon coming, basically, to run the world kind of thing. Quite a dark, very dark comic, quite graphic as well.
Well, you've just mentioned someone there who is also intrinsically linked to the Huxleys, H.P. Lovecraft.
Right, yeah.
Shares a similar bloodline.
Another name.
We'll mention.
He's another fella who's constantly dragged up and kept relevant over and over again, I think. I mean, I've got his book, all his writings here. I've read a couple of his stories and they're pretty good, but he's definitely someone who gets attention for attention.
He's lauded as the king of sci-fi, isn't he?
Horror, I'd say.
Horror, is it horror?
Yeah, he's more horror. I mean, they did a series recently about Lovecraft, and I never watched it, but I think it was called the Lovecraft, Land of Lovecraft or something, I think.
Right.
I can't remember what it was. It was a TV series, but I'm not massive familiar with stuff, but he's always dragged back out again like these people always are.
Well, just to go back through Alan Moore and his comics, he's a comic writer, novelist, short story writer, musician and cartoonist. He's also a magician and dark occultist, a Crowleyite. Moore actually is a ceremonial magician of ritual magic, high magic or learned magic, popularised by the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. Moore wrote V for Vendetta and The Watchman, and he used... what was the character, Chris, who used a smiley face?
The comedian in the comic of The Watchmen. He wears a badge, a smiley face badge.
Right.
And the way it was used in the comic was it had a blood splat on it. And the blood splat, if you remember the cover of The Watchmen, I'm sure everyone's seen it somewhere in the back of their head. It had a blood splat. Well, it was made into a film, wasn't it? Yeah. It had a blood splat, but the blood splat was... basically showing the doomsday clock.
Right.
So it was like 5 to 12.
And it's going to be very interesting how this sort of comes back full circle again from that, what you've just mentioned there. Yeah. Yeah, I was thrown from a hotel, blood splat, smiley face.
Well, I didn't mention that, but the way that the blood splat ends up on the smiley face is he's thrown from his apartment window onto the pavement. And then in the comic... obviously shows him land, shows him drop. Mm. And then, you know, to signify his death is the smiley face with the blood splat showing the doomsday clock. And all the way through the comic, it comes up again and again, and it shows it getting closer to midnight, basically. Because it's, I don't know if anyone's seen The Watchmen, it's about the slow build-up to the nuclear bomb dropping.
Right. I mean, we haven't even mentioned the Huxleys yet. I mean, we're obviously showing links here that they're... tentacles, if you like, or their energy or what their work has bled through or filtered through into other people's work. And a quote from Alan Moore said he had a documentary made called The Mindscape of Alan Moore. I don't know if you've seen it.
I saw it, and you know, I probably saw it when it came out, that fact, because I was so into that.
2003. He said, LSD was an incredible experience. Not that I'm recommending it for anybody else, well, you just have. But for me, it's kind of, it hammered home to me that reality was not a fixed thing. That the reality that we saw about us every day was one reality and a valid one, but there were others. Different perspectives where different things have meaning that were just as valid, that had a profound effect on me. Bear in mind now, this is coming from a dark occultist, a magician, and a ceremonial magician of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, saying that. It's not somebody having a trip, is it?
No. What do you think? Are you implying that he's a bad guy?
I don't know. I don't know what a bad guy is anymore, Chris. Because these people are writing things that we enjoy, doing and things that we enjoy. Yeah.
I mean, like, is it another hero you've got to throw out the window? Because I like Alan Moore. He's a very intelligent guy when you listen to him talking.
Are all these people intelligent?
Yeah, I mean... Mm. I mean, is he a pawn in it?
Ted Bundy were intelligent.
One thing I always found interesting about Alan Moore, he's quite vocal about the fact that his comics got turned into films because DC owned them and he didn't get any money for it. And he always denounces the comic, which is fair enough. But then From Hell, which I think was independently published, and that got turned into a film and he denounced that as well. But then you think, but you had control, not control, but you must have chose to sell that to a...
Didn't we hear all this with, like, Prince and George Michael, who said, when I own my own music and I can write what I want, I'll write stuff that I want. And when
Prince kind of did, didn't he? To be fair.
Well, I don't know. They all sounded the same to me. But when George Michael did it, he did it where he were dressed as a copper going into a men's toilet. You know what I mean? It was just like...
It sounded the same as well, didn't it?
Yeah, it just sounded exactly the same.
To be fair, Prince kind of went off on his own, didn't he?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm not saying I didn't. I like Prince, but I'm not saying it sounded right a lot different from when he were Prince or Symbol.
Yeah. So, but it's just an interesting side note that, I mean, I'm sure everyone's seen V for Vendetta fight. That mask, that V mask, is literally used for the, what will they call that movement? They call them that, definitely a dodgy.
Yeah.
Do you remember them ones used to, what were they called?
I don't know, but the.
You know what I mean, don't
they? Used them in London Bridge and stuff like that, didn't they?
Yeah, they were basically fight the power kind of characters. Yeah. I mean, that looked like a stage nonsense to me, to be honest.
But I mean, V for Vendetta, I mean, we talk about Huxley's work and Orwell's and people like that. V for Vendetta, well, just as bang on the money.
Yeah, it's up there, isn't it? Yeah, it's brilliant, brilliant comic, that is, by the way.
Yeah.
I wasn't so keen on the film when it came out, but because I was a bit of a comic snob. But as I got older, the film's actually pretty... The Wachowskis produced it, I believe. You know, the Matrix guys produced it.
Right.
Or girls turning to girls on the pair of them.
Have they? Honestly?
Yeah. Did you not know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, one of them's transgendered into a woman, and then the other one did.
Good for him.
Pair of brothers. Maybe we should do that.
I don't think that's going to happen, Chris.
Dominique.
Christine and Dominique. Yeah. I might not have a smiley face anymore. Talking of a smiley face, I just want to do a bit of background on the smiley face, because it was quite interesting when we started talking about this, actually. And it was quite accidental that we started talking about it, but then we realised it was used for acid, and the links to acid and LSD and Aldous Huxley, well, they can't get any stronger. A smiley, sometimes referred to as a smiley face, was first drawn by Harvey Ross Ball, who was an American commercial artist. Ball never applied for a trademark for the iconic smiley image and only earned $45 for his efforts. He designed the smiley in 1963, a year that strange coincidence has happened, which we'll get on to later. And the smiley would go on to be the symbol of the second summer of love in 88 to 89, as well as all the other things we've just discussed. The smiley story goes that the state Mutual Life Assurance Company of Worcester, sounds exciting, Massachusetts, now known as Hanover Insurance, they've jazzed it up a bit, had purchased the Guarantee Mutual Company of Ohio. The merger resulted in low employee morale. Maybe a name change would have worked. In an attempt to solve this, Mr. Ball was employed in 1963 as a freelance artist to come up with an image to increase morale. Ball started with a sunny yellow circle containing a smile. However, he wasn't happy that it could be turned upside down to make a frown. By adding two eyes, one slightly bigger than the other, like mine, he created a smiley face. So that's the story behind...
I never realised it had one eye bigger than the other.
Well, the original one has.
Right.
The ones that have been... The ones that trademark now haven't.
Right.
Yeah, they sort of slightly tweaked it here and there. I don't think the Acid House one has either.
No.
We'll come on to the company in a sec. It's also that Homer Simpson yellow, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Which isn't, again, used broadly, is it? Only for certain things.
Only for certain things. But again, the Homer Simpson thing, we were talking about this the other day, which, again, Huxley comes into a partly human potential movement. How, and the Esalen Institute that he was part of as well. The human potential movement, where they absolutely ruined family values, if you like. And so Homer Simpson and all these other characters have been used to destroy the male.
Well, I mean, when you think about the Simpsons, you know, making blokes look stupid. Look where we are now, Fire.
I know.
By 2023, I mean.
I know.
I don't know where we are.
No, I don't know where we are. Well, you just mentioned two guys who make films who you've seen interviewed over the years, the Wazowskis, who didn't look like women or bis or anything. They didn't speak like that. They never mentioned it once. And
one
now.
Of them's transformed quite a while ago, actually, quite a long time. And then the other one followed.
Right.
But they've made some interesting films in that world.
But again, if everybody's a Manchurian candidate, if all these people are Manchurian candidates, and out, we've explained, again, that's all part of the MKUltra thing, that's all part of the Huxley thing, the Tavistock thing, it's all Tavistock that's doing the sex changes and things like that. All of it's intertwined with this, and then they're into films and making films about...
Well, you do wonder, don't you? Like, The Matrix clearly had a lot of stuff in it. I mean, you can't even begin to talk about that. But no. Then they did V for Vendetta. Like I said, they produced that, I believe. And they also did Cloud Atlas, which is a heavy film. I've read the book of that, actually. The book's amazing. Yeah. The film's good, really good as well. But it's clearly pointing at, you know, all kinds of stuff. Reincarnation. It's got, you know, karma. It's got everything in it. And then you think that... I think if I'm right, their films are Warner Brothers. And you think, I think we've mentioned this before, that Time Warner. Why are they called Time Warner? Are they the good guys? Are they warning you of the time? You know, I don't know. I'm talking, but
I don't know. Again, you don't
I'm
know.
Not saying good, bad guy. I don't know. Yeah. But what I mean is, are they part of a faction? And they can't do anything, but they're warning us. Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers.
Maybe they think they're warning us. I don't know.
Who knows? Yeah. Or maybe it's just revelation of the method, even more so that, you know.
Yeah. I would say they're all probably part of some sort of cult, different cults coming together. Mm. The Smiley was introduced to France. I like it when they talk about, this was from Wikipedia, by the way, this bit. It was introduced to France. So why was it introduced to France in 1972? As a signal of a good news story in the newspaper, Francois. Frenchman Franklin Lefrane used the image and trademarked the image. So it weren't trademarked before. He trademarked it. Today, Nicolas Lefrane, the CEO of the Smiley Company, the global business behind one of the biggest licensing success stories of the past 50 years, it is a brand licensing company based in London. It holds the rights to the Smiley face in over 100 countries. The Smiley brand has revenues in 2020 of $538 million.
Bloody hell. I bet that other guy is popular with his family.
He's passed away now, him. I don't think he was short of a bob, to be fair to him. But, we were discussing the Smileys, and it led us into another. I think your missus said this, that she said, well, the Smileys are part of the emoji explosion. No,
well, it wasn't that. She just literally said, that's like, because I was telling her what we were talking about. She said, that's literally the original emoji, isn't it? Yeah. Just in a passing comment. Isn't it?
Yeah,
same colour.
Yeah. She does have her uses.
Yeah. Not just football.
But yeah. So the emojis are part of another phenomenon developed in the 90s by a Japanese interface designer, Shigetaka Kurita. I didn't do too bad with that one, Chris.
Didn't do too bad there, yeah.
Often cited for his early work with emoji sets. He was part of a team that created one of the first emojis used solely for communication, the first being a heart-shaped pictogram that appeared on the NTT Docomo pager aimed at teenagers. Interesting. Right. Heart-shaped, yeah. It went on to become the red heart emoji. So that was the first one. The Docomo emoji set he created is now on display at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. That's how important it is. The idea of the Museum of Modern Art, by the way, was developed in 1929 by Abby Aldrich Rockefeller, wife of John D. Rockefeller Jr.
A little side project for his missus.
Yes. NTT Docomo Incorporated, Docomo meaning everywhere in Japanese, and he's a Japanese mobile phone operator owned by the giant Nippon Telegraph and Telephone Corporation, or NTT, which was operated by AT&T during the occupation of Japan after the war, and is ranked 55th in the Fortune Global 500, valued at $107 billion. The Smiley was amongst the first set of 176 coloured emojis called the Grinning Face.
Right.
Which leads you into the clowns and Nephilim.
Sounds a bit more sinister, the grinning face, doesn't it? Than Smiler.
Yeah. Listen to this though, Chris. Interestingly, AT&T morphed from a company Alexander Graham Bell set up with his even more interesting father-in-law, a man called Gardiner Green Hubbard, an American financier. In 1899, the Bell Telephone Company became AT&T. Bell and Green were also pioneers of wax-coated cardboard cylinders and discs, first used on graphophones, I presume are similar to gramophones. This company would go on to become Columbia Records.
Oh, ISIS Records.
ISIS Records. Now owned by Sony Music Entertainment, a subsidiary of Sony Corporation, America, with a market capitalization of $120 billion. We're talking about the biggest corporations here, pumping out emojis, smiley faces for a mutual assurance company.
It's funny, isn't it? Because you just thought there was something that your phone had
just appeared on your phone.
Yeah.
Well, where do we actually think these things come from?
Yeah, you don't realize it.
You don't realize, do you? It was strange, Chris, because we read a book, right, called The Carnivals of Life and Death by James Shelby Downard. Remember that book?
Yeah.
We got it from Crow 777. He talked about Graham Shelby and Ilana Freeland and Michael Hoffman. They talk about James Shelby Downard. I think Michael Hoffman wrote a book with James Shelby Downard, and I think Ilana Freeland did some writing and ghostwriting or editing for some of the books. Anyway, the young Downard claims he saw Alexander Graham Bell involved in sex magic rituals on Jekyll Island. You remember that part?
Yeah, I remember
that
bit, yeah. Bloody crazy, that book, innit?
Absolutely crazy. I recommend reading it.
Carnivals of Life and Death. Did you mention that?
Yeah, Carnivals of Life and Death.
It's bonkers. I mean, I wonder if it's actually, is it true or is it written in code or what is it?
I don't know, but there's some bonkers stories in that.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about that book within this a couple of times, not with isn't this one, but further on in the other parts,
right.
Because there's a part in that book, and I know we're just moving off a little bit, that he talks about crockery being made out of bone china.
Yeah.
And the Masons use human bones as part of a ritual.
Yeah.
Well,
is that
the Huxleys? The Huxleys.
Where China came from?
Well, it was made out of animal bones, but they introduced human bones in it. But the Huxleys are married into and related into the Wedgwoods,
the famous pottery company, Stoke-on-Trent.
That were Quakers.
Was it Stoke-on-Trent?
That were Quakers that set up a, we're going to come into this as well, that set up a group called the Lunar Society.
Right.
Yeah, so that's an interesting topic, actually. Anyway, so we've got two mentions now of sex magic people or ritual magic, whatever you want to call it, within this, in the first...
occult spinnings, I'd say, wouldn't it?
Yeah, occult spinnings within the first hour. Graham Bell was definitely an active Freemason. I think he was part of a lodge called Harmony Lodge number 17. And one of his friends was a grandmaster. I've been trying to dig out his friend's name, but I couldn't get the first name, so I'm not even going to say it. AT&T are also a part of the military intelligence industrial establishment. For instance, Room 641A, sounds sinister, is a telecommunication interception facility operated by AT&T for the US NSA, or National Security Agency, as part of its warrantless surveillance program as authorized by the Patriot Act. And the New York Times has reported that AT&T is selling personal customer information to the CIA. And these are mainstream stories. Alexander Bell was an honorary president of the Second International Eugenics Congress, in 1921, and a proponent of eugenics. Now remember, Sir Julian Huxley was president of the British Eugenics Society, and the Huxleys, as we shall see, are also intermarried with the Darwins and the Galtons. So they're right in the invention of eugenics or genetics.
Even before old Hitler got involved.
Yeah. So the smiley face is linked with the Second Summer of Love from 88 to 89, where people were again drugged out of their heads, this time on MDMA known as ecstasy. So they're even calling something like they've got a smiley face for acid and they're calling this ecstasy. So again, it's that.
Where did X about? Was it a bit later? Was it like 90s? For again in 90s,
late 80s. I think 80s, mate. It were 80s.
Late 80s.
80s. Yeah.
I remember that period of time because I remember ecstasy tablets at that time. Not that I took loads, but they were £20 a pop.
Right.
Going back to early 90s.
Right. I don't think I don't know what the price they are now, but I bet they're not £20 a pop now.
No, what I'm saying is on the relevance of inflation or whatever, how much is that in today's money? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I reckon they were probably a lot stronger then than they are now.
Yeah.
A lot more watered down and toxic probably now as well. Whether they were toxic or not, I'm not saying they were only a five a day, but so when you look at this, what was the second Summer of Love, organic or another Tavistock controlled event, as in the first Summer of Love?
I think going on what I know now, I would say it was an orchestrated event.
Yeah, I would as well. MDA was first developed in 1912 by German pharmaceutical company Merck. It was used in the 1970s to enhance psychotherapy and became a popular street drug in the 1980s. Is this Huxley's Soma?
Right, yeah. Yeah. Well, I would think his Soma would be prescribed. I wouldn't think it'd be a street drug.
Well, it could be both, couldn't it?
Yeah.
It could be, because obviously he did say basically I'm going to drug you out of your mind and you'll be happy, which is what Klaus Schwab's saying, you will own nothing and be happy.
What better way to do it, Fatty? You've got people who won't take pharmaceuticals. Those people are the kind of people that would probably take recreational drugs. So you're covering all bases, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. I found this bit interesting. The Merck Group, commonly known as Merck, is a German multinational science and technology company headquartered in Darmstadt with about 60,000 employees and in present, it's in 66 countries. Just smack me around the face with it. Yeah, yeah.
It just makes you wonder, is it like 64 countries and 59,000?
Yeah, but they had to put it there.
Just round it off.
Just round it off and put 666 there. The Merck family was a German family of industrialists, bankers, what else, known for establishing the world's oldest pharmaceutical company, as well as the Hamburg Merchant Bank. The family still owns a majority shares in the pharmaceutical company Merck. During the interwar years, George Merck oversaw Merck's involvement in the development of synthetic vitamins, sulfurs, antibiotics, and hormones. George Merck was president of Merck & Co. pharmaceutical firm in the US. During World War II, George led the US War Research Service with Frank Olson, which initiated the US Biological Weapons Program. Frank Olson, PhD, was an American bacteriologist, biological warfare scientist, and an employee of the United States Army Biological Warfare Laboratories, USBWL. Who worked at Camp Dietrich, now Fort Dietrich, in Maryland. The War Research Service was also headquartered at Fort Dietrich, so they both worked together. And this now brings us full circle to the Huxley, MKUltra, Alan Moore, LSD, and the Smiley Face connection. You remember the name, I'm sure most of you, Frank Olson. Now let's go back to Alan Moore's Watchman character again, Chris, the comedian. Explain what happened to the comedian.
Well, like I said, he basically, at the beginning of the Watchmen comic book, gets lobbed out of a window down and dies numerous stories, and then that's when the Doomsday Smiley Face Watchmen logo comes from, with the splat of blood aimed at 5 to 12. Now, I get the link, because I was telling you this, and then you went, oh my God, that's Frank Olson.
Exactly. It turns out that Frank Olson was covertly dosed with LSD by his colleague, Sidney Gottlieb.
Gottlieb.
Then head of the CIA's MKUltra program. 9 days later, he plunged to his death from the window of the Hotel Statler in New York on November the 28th, 1953. The Statler Hotel in New York became the Hotel Pennsylvania. The Statler Hotel chain was sold to Hilton Hotels in 1954, the year after. The Rockefeller Commission, a trustworthy commission, reported on the CIA in 1975, acknowledged their having conducted covert drug studies on fellow agents. So not just on the population or the army or unwilling prisoners in prisons, but they actually, hey, mate, do you want a drink? Yeah, here's 25 trips.
I remember watching stuff about that. I mean, have you ever seen the film Jacob's Ladder?
I've never watched it, Chris. No.
That goes into that world. And I remember reading about this years and years and years ago. And I think his family are still trying to sue for saying that they murdered his the dad or granddad or whatever. But yeah, it's a very similar story, isn't it?
But this is all around the same timeline, isn't it? The 50s, Aldous Huxley was banging to this LSD. I mean, it was before that, but it was... So he was part of all this...
Is that window throw a coincidence? That's more to the point. Is that a coincidence?
Again, when you're doing this research, the same names seem to pop up. The same families seem to pop up, even though there's different characters intermixing with them.
Same and weird instances.
The same like weird instances pop up.
Window throw, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's smiley face also, and we'll come on to this in a bit, but that smiley face of the comedian with the head splat, then you've got, it was written in, smiley face was in 1963, and JFK got shot through head. And that blood splat is right where he got shot.
Yeah.
That's the
triangle of smiley faces.
Yeah, exactly. Olson's death is one of the most mysterious outcomes of the CIA mind control project, MKUltra. The US government first described his death as a suicide and then as misadventure, while others allege murder.
He's got Gottlieb. He's got Gottlieb, that guy who said he had like the best job in the world. Is that him?
Yes.
He was setting up stings with prostitutes and LSD and all that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There were a few of them. I think that might be Jolly West.
Right.
Which we're going to come on to in a bit. But
all right,
there were quite a lot of them doing that, weren't there? But Gottlieb was the guy who was heading up MKUltra.
Right.
Do you know what? I edited so much out of this part because I didn't want it to be a big part of this. I wanted it to be just to show that these people are all intertwined with this. I mean,
I know that one of them, I saw one of them described it as he had the best job in the world because he could just do what he wanted.
Yeah.
I don't know which one of these.
Well, this guy's got a free ticket. This guy's got a free ticket, basically.
And some of the stuff he described reminded you of that prostitute bit in Godfather where they set
him up. Right, yeah. Yeah, it did. Yeah. It also reminds you of like Jason Bourne, doesn't it? When he's. It's that type of. I mean, one of the guys, we'll come on to him in a sec. Gottlieb conducted experiments with cannabis or THC, a derivative from cannabis, cocaine, heroin, and mescaline. He realized that CSD had not been properly tested or investigated by the agency. Oh, that's a shame, isn't it? So he might as well do it himself. Gottlieb used physicians such as Scottish-born Donald Ewan Cameron and Harris Isbell in controversial psychiatric research, including non-conscientious human experiments. And if you remember, we talked about Donald Cameron in the Trudeau one, because he was, I think he was at Toronto University, and they got sued 20, 30 years later for conducting these experiments. And
I think they even admitted that they went into tube stations and released gases and down alleyways and then followed the people in them alleyways. I think that's admitted, isn't it?
It is admitted, And we I mean, this is not dissimilar from Operation Cauldron that we were talking about. That came out of Fort Detrick and Lyme disease as well. All these things come out of this era, where they were spraying and dropping ticks and all across length and breadth of Britain and Europe and
But your government America. Loves you. And the government loves you and they just want you to take that thing.
Trust us.
Trust us while we get you an headlock and garrote you.
Yeah, its efficacy is 100%. But it's not, the efficacy is not what we're telling you it is. Gottlieb administered LSD and other hallucinogenic drugs to unwitting subjects and financed psychiatric research and development of techniques that he said would crush the human psyche to the point that he would admit anything.
Nice. Lovely. Thank you, Gottlieb.
These are his own words. An interesting link to Gottlieb, and back then, full circle to the Summer of Love and like the Doors and things like that, is a link to Louis Jolyon West, known as Jolly West, who pioneered research into the use and abuse of LSD. I think he actually drugged up an elephant or something like that at one point.
That sounds familiar. I've heard that story.
Yeah. West received funds from the CIA through the Human Ecology Fund, and West became part of the MKUltra project. Author Tom O'Brien in his book Chaos, it's a fantastic book. I'm just reading halfway through it, actually. Big book. Yeah, it took him 20 odd years to, yeah. We mentioned two good books there to buy if you're going to want to look at some books. Anyway, he uncovered links to Gottlieb West and West's involvement in a program with Charles Manson in the late 50s and early 60s, well before the Tate LaBianca killings. He was also appointed as Jack Ruby's psychiatrist.
Jack Ruby Slippers.
Yeah, Jack Ruby Slippers. And so we've now come to, is Jack Ruby's psychiatrist, Huxley, JFK died on exactly the same day. He's now going and drugging Jack Ruby. He pronounced Jack Ruby psychotic and delusional after the first 45-minute meeting.
Skilled psychiatrist.
Yeah. He said he suggested further interrogation. So bear in mind, is his psychiatrist, but he's talking about interrogation, not questioning or helping. Yeah. Under the influence of sodium pentothal and hypnosis.
I'm guessing sodium pentothal is a truth serum of sorts, is it?
Yeah. But they also use it. Sodium pentothal or sodium thiopental is on the World Health Organization list of essential medicines. And it's used to induce medical comas and used in the US to execute prisoners by lethal injection.
Fucking hell. Wow.
It's an essential medicine, Chris.
Right. Should be in everyone's cabinet.
Yeah. Jack, this is one of your five a day.
With a little skull and crossbones on it.
So Jack Ruby's diagnosis of total mental breakdown happened after the first of West's consultations. According to Tom O'Brien's book, Chaos, West had bragged that he could brainwash a subject within a short period of time and turn them into a Manchurian candidate or totally destroy them mentally.
Bloody hell. Well, it sounds like that guy's ego is just out of control, so he would admit that, wouldn't he? Because he's going around bragging about it.
Yeah, so you've got the guy who employed him at bragging that he can destroy somebody and turn them to jellyfish.
Yeah.
And you've got the guy he's employed saying he could turn him to jellyfish. You've got the other two guys that worked at universities that have been sued for brainwashing people.
Well, you imagine these have all been given free rein to do all these experiments. Yes. Right.
These are the ones we know about.
They're untouchable, so you can imagine their egos. So they're going around shouting the fat mouths off about it, aren't they?
So we've got, at the time of the shooting of a possible Manchurian candidate one, Lee Harvey Oswald, on November the 24th, 1963, my Manchurian candidate two, Jack Ruby, who at the time was also taking metadrine, a central nervous system stimulant.
I have to point out as well, fairly quickly, and it's not me who found this out, but I always find that fascinating, the Oz, Jack Ruby Slippers and the Wizard of Oswald connection.
But that was Shelby Downard.
Was it? Right.
That was in his book. We're going to talk about that in a minute, actually. He called it The Killing of the King, or King 33.
I've never read that one. Yeah. But Wizard of Oz is often used in the MKUltra world, isn't it, I suppose?
Yes.
I mean, you can't dispute that link, can you?
Well, I don't think you can. The Killing of Oswald by Jack Ruby Slippers. I mean, come on. I mean, do you know when I heard that on Crow 777?
Is that where it was? I knew it.
It was Crow 777, yeah. Right. When I heard that on there, because I know when Crow found it out, you could tell that he'd gone, oh my, you know what he gets quite excited when he learns something like that.
Slap the top of your head moment.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, so at the time that he killed Lee Harvey Oswald, he was taking fenmetrazine, which is a stimulant for his central nervous system. It'd be interesting to see who's giving him all these drugs.
Well, we know that guy, wasn't it?
He couldn't even... When they interviewed him, he couldn't even remember being in the underground.
Right.
He couldn't remember anywhere. So, yeah. So behind the Flower Power Summer of Love in 1967 and the second Summer of Love in the UK in 1988 to 89, there were powerful sources at play. The smiley face, to me, seems a little bit more sinister now, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So why mention this information about the first and second Summer of Love? LSD, MKUltra, CIA, Tavistock, etc. Well, The Huxleys, Sir Julian Huxley, Aldous Huxley, and their younger brother, Sir Andrew Huxley, were the generation of Huxleys in the mix of this academic science religion. And here we have Fort Detrick mentioned, who along with the UK's Porton Down, were used for projects like Operation Cauldron or Operation LAC, the large area coverage trials, that poisoned us and generations before us and still do in a huge eugenics operation. I mean, what on earth are they doing now?
Well, chemtrails.
Yeah, exactly. Then they employed lunatics like Sidney Gottlieb, who in turn employed Donald Cameron, Harris Isbell, and Jolly West to conduct experiments using LSD and other drugs to mass mind control populations. And then we have Sir Julian Huxley, president of the Eugenics Society, and the person who basically invented transhumanism. And then we talk about two well-known producers of films to changing the sex. Mm. Just in this conversation, we're talking about that. Yeah. Who came up with the films V for Vendetta and things like that. Then we have Aldous Huxley, who many say actually ran Tavistock and possibly MK Ultra, and used LSD with Timothy Leary, who wrote dystopian novels that have a habit of coming true. Then we have Sir Andrew Huxley, the president of the Royal Society, who married, this is interesting, we're going to come on to this in further episodes, he married Jocelyn Resende Gemmell, her maiden name was Pease, the daughter of geneticist Michael Pease, son of Edward R. Pease, founding member of the Fabian Society, and one of the founding families of Barclays Bank, and his wife Helen Bowen Wedgwood, eldest daughter of the first Lord Wedgwood, part of the Darwin Wedgwood family. Relative of left-wing Viscount Tony Wedgwood Benn.
Hmm. So Darwin making little china cups out of your bones. Nice. Gives it a whole new look, doesn't it, when you see those like old colonial English things where they're drinking tea, you know, drinking tea out of those little
tea with them long wigs on.
Yeah. And you know, and probably the enemy's bones. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they've used bones as trophies for...
Do you know, I never knew that bone china was made of bones, actually, you mentioned it. I didn't know that.
Isn't it weird how it's called bone china, and we would never think it were called made out of bones?
No, I didn't know that.
I think it's bone powder. Well, it's bone powder, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense, because it's so strong. It's quite strong and translucent, isn't it?
But it's a different cup, isn't it? It's not like a normal pottery. It's like clay. Yeah. It is actually a difference.
It's so fine you can see light through it. Yeah.
My missus' dad, he likes drinking tea through proper bone china.
Right.
Old school type.
Have I even ever seen any bone china? I don't even know.
I don't know. Interestingly, that these guys were bang smack in the founding of the Fabian Society. And a British socialist organisation whose purpose is to advance the principles of social democracy and democratic socialism via gradualist and reformist efforts in democracies, rather than by revolutionary overthrow. That's just a nudge that Mickey uses.
I was going to say, that sounds like the original of all the other foundations and societies you talk about now. Mm. Sounds like the blueprint, doesn't it?
Well, listen to this, right?
The Fabian Society... Make it sound nice.
Yeah, the Fabian Society's purpose is to promote greater equality of power, wealth and opportunity, the value of collective action and public service, an accountable, tolerant and active democracy, citizenship, liberty and human rights, sustainable development and multilateral international cooperation.
Oh God, that's even more so, isn't it, than what I just said? It's like, oh God, they were doing it even then. Wow.
Yeah. That is like... You know, the Fabian Society, that was the World Economic Forum, wasn't it?
I was going to say, you could take any of them foundations and whatever you've talked about over the last 2 or 3 years, and you could, it's just a blueprint for that, isn't it?
Yes.
A lot of words that sound lovely, but really they're to fucking bend you over and rod you and bring the cousins.
But bear in mind, I mean, a lot of these, like Keir Starmer, Romper Stomper, he's a member at Fabian Society, Bill Iyer was. You know, all these people are all members of this that then go to the World Economic Forum, that are then interviewed by Bill Gates, that are then you know, go to all the same clubs and whatever meetings.
It's the same word, in fact. It's the same word, and it's the same little sentence, isn't it?
And I think they write these things to know, let the other people know that they're in their club.